How many of you were here the last time I was here? Oh, hardly anybody. That means I have no lasting appeal anymore, but now I've got you, and I can do the exact same show as the last time and get away with it. Actually, no, there's this little problem of terrorism and this supposed war on terrorism that's getting in the way of doing the same show again, isn't there? I mean, is anybody as creeped out as I am when somebody like Bush says, "You are with us, or are you with the terrorists?" I don't like that kind of bullying, personally. Now, of all time, we should not be afraid to say, "Wait a minute, we are not with Bush or the terrorists. There has got to be a better way." Jimmy Carter publicly warned the last George Bush that his Gulf War would set back peace and Middle Eastern relations at least 20 years. Now what happens? Now what do we do? I fear a mass slaughter of innocent civilians far greater than the World Trade Center, with the clown prince of the Texas oil barons being handed the keys to the weapons of mass destruction, while Israel is being throttled by their own Saddam Hussein by the name of Ariel Sharon. I fear governments all over the world rounding up and attacking anyone who opposes their policies for any reason on the grounds that they must be sympathizing with terrorism. Like when the United States of America rounded up and locked up thousands of immigrants and labor activists in the 1920s because they had opposed World War I. With us or with the terrorists? I mean, there's already all kinds of bullying and intimidation not to even say anything or oppose anything these people are doing. There was a TV show host in America from a show called Politically Incorrect called Bill Maher, who made a joke, I thought it was a good comment, that it was a cowardly attack on the World Trade Center, and it was also cowardly to fire missiles at people from 2,000 miles away. For that, he got yelled at, bullied, and finally he sheepishly retracted the comment, and Ari Fleischer, Bush's press secretary, said, "Yep, people have to watch what they say and watch what they do." And here it's being used to usher in the long-awaited national ID cards. I read something today that they're backpedaling on that now. But, you have to give up some of your rights to fight terrorism, just like you were supposed to give up some of your rights to fight drugs. Remember that one? And the supposed Democratic Party opposition in the American Congress is rolling over like puppy dogs, and suddenly Bush is the kitty cat's meow. Before, there was so much opposition to drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that Bush decided not to even try and get the law passed. But now they announce, "Oh, no problem anymore. We have to fight terrorism. Let's drill for oil in Alaska. That'll show them." And the oil apparently is slated to be sold to China, not to ease any sort of electricity shortage down in the lower part of America that oil wouldn't do much for anyway, not as much as conservation would anyway. But Bush's vice president said, "Well, energy conservation is an antiquated 70s idea." Meanwhile, even scarier, they decided to roll over and play dead and give Bush a blank check to build whatever crazy space weapon nuke thing he wants to put in outer space, if they even know what they want to put in outer space. And that really scares me a lot more than I'm scared of Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein, because if one of those things with the nuclear warheads and all malfunctions and comes back to Earth like the Russian Mir space station that crashed recently, for example, it's going to burn as it comes into the atmosphere. And what happens when things like that burn? They blow. And when it blows, that's plutonium dust all over the Earth's atmosphere. I fear an ever-rising backlash against people of Arab descent both in this country where, what was it, night before last, a mosque was firebombed in Edinburgh the same night I was there. And in America, there's been several cases of people attacking mosques, leaving severed pig's heads in the parking lot. One guy finally gets to open his gas station after all these years, opening his own business. First day of business, a pickup truck drives by and the guy shoots him, blows his head off because he had a turban on. That kind of thing. And I also fear for what's going to happen to the actual soldiers dispatched into this war on terrorism. America in particular has a very poor record lately of taking care of its veterans after wars. There's lots of people on the streets at intersections or in the middle of major streets and the little barrier, the median, holding up signs saying homeless Vietnam veteran will work for food. That never should have happened. And the people who came back from the Gulf War have gotten all kinds of ailments, which are being put under the umbrella term of Gulf War syndrome. Everything from not being quite right in the head to double vision, splitting headaches, spazzing out, deformed children. And they're saying, oh, well, just like the Agent Orange in Vietnam, which our government still won't acknowledge, caused a whole bunch of cancer and birth defects in veterans' kids, as well as many, many millions more in Vietnam. Well, they won't acknowledge what's called Gulf War syndrome now either. And there's several theories as to what may have caused it, any or all of the above. There was an experimental anthrax vaccine we shot all the troops up with, and they would have been thrown in the brig if they wouldn't take the vaccine. That might have done it. Maybe Saddam Hussein did have germ bombs of some kind and that did something. Or maybe, just maybe, at least some of this was caused by our use of depleted uranium shells. Shells coated with depleted uranium designed to pierce through the armor of tanks, blow them up from the inside, and what do you get after that thing blows? Radiation. And yes, we use them in Kosovo too. Hey, Kosovars, we just got you your land back and look what we did to it too. Aren't you pleased? NATO is your friend. One of my own relatives went to the Gulf War as a medic, and when he came back, he's never been quite right in the head since. He hasn't been able to hold a job, and kind of a rocky relationship with people around him. The last I heard, he and his family were living in the back of a church where he swept up now and then. And according to my family, if I'm not mistaken, what really flipped him out was after all the bombing and everything, all these Iraqi kids crying their eyes out began coming into the Allied soldiers' camps wondering where their parents were, wondering what they were going to do, wondering where they could find something to eat. And that may have sent him over the edge. I fear that after we've blown up and killed every living thing in Afghanistan and Iraq, Osama bin Laden will emerge on the mountaintop from the one cave they miss and tell his by then mushrooming following, "I told you so." Even if we succeed in wiping out the millions of people who already agree with him, what will their kids be like? What will their kids be like? Supposedly, bin Laden has 51 of his own through only 3 or 4 wives. Look no further than how young those kids throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers are. There's your answer. There's got to be a better way. I wish I knew what it was. None of our lives will ever be the same again. I got the word in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, of all places, where a friend from Atlanta woke me up out of some badly needed sleep, saying, is the show still going to happen at the university tonight? It's 9 in the morning. Why are you asking me that? I don't get up till 2. Surely you understand these things. But haven't you been watching the news? No, I was asleep. Well, two planes that were hijacked crashed into the World Trade Center and another one hit the Pentagon. Wow. Okay, call you later. I'm going back to bed. Couldn't sleep. Turned on the TV. And there it was across the bottom of the screen the minute it came on. World Trade Center destroyed. Both buildings collapse. Then it hit me. Oh, shit. Like the San Francisco earthquake and my sister's death, the true heavy magnitude of the event just avalanched more and more by the hour and would not stop. Show canceled. That part of the tour canceled. No flights out of Alabama. I offered to go on the campus radio station and say a few words if they thought it would help. They did not. My friends from Atlanta offered to make the 3 or 4 hour drive out anyway, just so we could be together as the horror unfolded, and I'm glad they did, because by then I was beginning to realize I didn't just want to sit in a room all alone as this whole thing played out. We thought, so this is what people go through in other parts of the world, sometimes on a daily basis. Like Israel, where the mere act of boarding a bus is risking a death sentence. Or Palestine. Or Iraq, which we've never stopped bombing. Or Sarajevo, or Belgrade, or Chechnya, or Kosovo. Or Belfast, where I go at the end of the tour. Up till now, we in the United Snakes of America have just been damn lucky. Now, we've joined the rest of the world's 21st century. The fever for war grew by the hour as the media reports came in. CNN, of course, had all the different angles of the plane flying into the second building, finally got one of the plane going into the first building. CBS was probably the best coverage. Fox, owned by Sky TV's Rupert Murdoch, was by far the worst. They were looking for the instant tabloid scandal angle, and they couldn't quite get a grip that there was a little more going on here. This wasn't just another story of the congressman and the intern. This was a little more than that. But it grew first as, and you could tell as the logos changed. There's always logos for disasters and scandals now on news shows. Some lucky web geek got the job of being able to come up with instant disaster or scandal logos whenever required. Attack on America. America fights back. America's new war. It grew and grew into that over and over again. Kablam! Another angle. Kablam! Another angle. Kablam! And over again, the building just imploding and falling with all those people inside, not even being able to think how they'd get out because it went down in a matter of seconds. Again and again and again, you couldn't help but have a pretty deep, gut-wrenching reaction. But then we began to think, whoa, what about false images, too? We got to be careful of those. First one that came to mind was the one of the celebrating Palestinians, which has then been alleged that CNN actually dug up footage from 1991 that they used for that. And I heard one claim that it couldn't possibly be real because it was nighttime over there and the footage was in daytime. Maybe. I can't remember what hour I saw that footage, so I can't do the math and try and figure it out. Although I must say, the grinning woman in the front of that footage they show over and over again, her glasses sure looked like something you would have wanted to replace by 1991. You never know. The Gulf War. Now, there was some clever false imagery for you. Did they have the story in the papers over here about those savage Iraqi soldiers storming hospitals in Kuwait? Saddam Hussein's army was doing to her country. Please, please help us. Please do something. Turned out that story was planted and that woman hired by the Hill and Knowlton Advertising Agency, who were employed by the Kuwaiti royal family to get the Americans to get them their throne back. And what about this story in The Guardian that there was an informal meeting of diplomats in Berlin in a hotel last July? America, Russia, Iran, Pakistan, the Northern Alliance, and Taliban invited but didn't attend, where the American representative just said, we're getting ready to go after bin Laden and we're going to try and overthrow the Taliban. And the Pakistanis were welcome to pass that message to the Taliban and apparently did. That's interesting. So are the reports that Bush's first partner in the oil business in a venture called Arbusto Energy was Salem bin Laden, older brother of Osama, who later died in a plane crash in Texas. Obviously, those disasters really did happen, and somebody is responsible. But what if they just picked this guy to give somebody something to focus on and vent their anger, because they didn't know who the hell is doing it? Or worse yet, they do know who's doing it, but they don't want to move on them because they're our quote-unquote friends. That's happened before, too. Ronald Reagan bombed Libya after a bomb went off in a German disco and killed an American soldier. Gaddafi was almost killed, and one of his children was killed. Reagan proudly proclaiming afterwards, "We gave him a bloody nose." But it also quickly came out that they knew from the get-go that the people who did that were working for the Syrian government and their dictator, Hafez Assad, but we didn't want to go bomb Damascus because Assad was too crucial to the Mideast peace process that still never seems to produce any lasting peace. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, where North Vietnamese gunboats supposedly fired on an American ship, and therefore we had to send all 500,000 troops into Vietnam, 50,000 to their deaths, and who knows how many millions of Vietnamese. Now it's largely admitted the Gulf of Tonkin incident really didn't happen that way at all. And we did that in the Spanish-American War at the beginning of the 20th century. Ship called the Maine blows up in a harbor in Cuba. And to this day, nobody knows whether it was a boiler explosion or whether somebody really did plant a bomb. But out it came in the newspapers, especially the ones owned by William Randolph Hearst, the guy who the Citizen Kane movie was made about. Remember the Maine! Remember the Maine! We must go to war and fight Spain and all. Sure enough, we did. For a while, we had Cuba and the Philippines as our reward. So in that light, what was our last Gulf War really about? What was it really for? Not oil. We already had oil. I don't think the oil companies could care whether they're buying the oil from the Kuwaiti dictatorship or the Iraqi dictatorship. OPEC sets the price. Who cares? No. It was to showcase all these fancy new military toys that we wanted to sell to the oil sheiks and other countries around the world. See, look what this one does. Look what this one does. And after we sold you a bunch of them, we'll sell your rivals some too. And then when you shoot each other, we'll sell you all some more. The Gulf War was like a product fair, a showcase of new armaments. And other things that I still can't quite buy in this whole story. They really took over those planes with box cutters and plastic knives? I mean, if I was flying a plane with a lot of people on it and somebody came in and put a plastic knife to my head and said, fly this plane to the World Trade Center, I would at least consider beating the crap out of them first. Then, finally, Bush comes back on TV after being AWOL for several hours. Oh, he's in Louisiana. No, he's in Nebraska. And I was thinking, no, he's up in the Bush family mansion in Maine. Hey, Dad, what do I do now? What do I do? You said this is going to be easy. There he was, looking like a deer in the headlights. He always gives off this vibe, like he knows he doesn't belong where he is. And unless his words to the public are carefully scripted, a la Ronald Reagan, amazing things start to come out of his mouth, which, if anybody were able to read them, they might think twice about trusting him with the keys to a possible world war. My Bush collection, to date. My first exposure to him was when he accepted the nomination at the Republican convention, looking like a rich frat boy trying to get on the college debate team or something. The podium even looked like it was too big for him. Like, we're going to make America strong and make America proud. I will restore honesty and dignity to the White House. And he actually came right out and said on national TV, don't mess with Texas. I hope that's not what this turns into in the Middle East, too. Finishing the job for his father to finally conquer Iraq and teach Saddam Hussein a lesson that you don't mess with Texas. This is a guy who somehow became president in spite of thinking of people from Greece as Grecians, Kosovians. He called Jimmy Carter a European-style socialist. And he thought the TV show Friends was a movie, and back when he was campaigning, he thought the Taliban was a rock band. His wife has announced that her first lady pet project is going to be education, perhaps because of the urgent needs of her husband, who knows. And he addresses the topic, rarely is the question asked, is our children learning? I will have a foreign-handed foreign policy. One of the common denominators I have found is that expectations rise above that which is expected. I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully. Oh, here we go. The depth of George Bush. It is clear our nation is reliant upon big foreign oil. More and more of our imports come from overseas. He really came out and said that. And perhaps you have heard there was a serious electricity and natural gas shortage, energy crisis in California last spring and winter and into the summer, with a lot of unconscionably high utility bills being handed to people, too. In January, mine went from $75 to $500. Yeah. And Bush's response was, the California crunch really is the result of not enough power generating plants, and then not enough power to power the power of generating plants. Natural gas is hemispheric. I like to call it hemispheric because it is a product that we can find in our neighborhoods. And hey, if he and Cheney have their way and they get rid of all the pollution laws, there will be net gas leaks in everybody's neighborhoods. Maybe they can blow up like the ones in Guadalajara when the sewers blew and killed all those people. And speaking of life, I think this is a abortion quote, but I'm not quite sure. It is important for us to explain to our nation that life is important. It's not only life of babies, but life of children living in, you know, the dark dungeons of the internet. Families is where our nation finds hope, where wings take dream. Will the highways on the internet become more few? I know how hard it is for you to put food on your family. And with ones like that, people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, stop criticizing this man. We've already anointed him our next fearless leader. You're picking on the disabled here. The guy's dyslexic. And I mean no offense to dyslexic people. There's at least two in my own family, and they've been through a lot of hell because of it. But I kind of worry that if the president is dyslexic and there's a war to fight, what's going to happen when he has all those buttons to play with? Hey, Dick! Hey, Colin! Come here, man! Come here, man! Hey, what does these buttons do? What does this one do? Am I bombing anybody? You just launched nuclear missiles against China. Oh, let's push this one. That'll recall them. No, that's the can't recall them button, George. That's what I worry about. What I am against is quotas. I am against hard quotas. Quotas, they basically delineate based upon whatever. However they delineate quotas, I think vulcanized society. So I don't know how that fits into what everybody else is saying, their relative positions, but that's my position. I mean, you got to admit this is a hell of a lot more entertaining than if Gore was president right now. Did I just hear a cell phone? It sounded like it was from over here somewhere. Where? Is that where it came from? You bring a Beavis and Butthead moment to mind. One of my favorites, actually. When somebody calls up and Beavis and Butthead are working at Burger World, and Beavis gets a phone order and throws the phone in the chip fryer. Pulls it out, it's just this piece of melted plastic, and all, you're pretty cool, Beavis. That is the solution to the mobile phone menace. A day of insurrection. Where all over the world, people sneak up on the ones walking down, bumping everybody out of the way because they're busy talking on their phones, grab the phones, run, and throw them in the chip fryer. Or to avoid the aggravated robbery charge, at least run around the block with them a few times and say, okay, here, you're not going to forget this the rest of the day, are you? After all, you leave your ringer on in here, you're interrupting the wit and wisdom of King George II. This is a world that is much more uncertain than the past. In the past, we were certain. We were certain it was us versus the Russians in the past. We were certain, and therefore, we had huge nuclear arsenals aimed at each other to keep the peace. That's what we were certain of. You see, even though it's an uncertain world, we're certain of some things. We're certain that even though the evil empire may have passed, evil still remains. We're certain there are people that can't stand what America stands for. We're certain there are madmen in this world, and there's terror, and there's missiles, and I'm certain of this, too. And then, when Carlo Giuliani, the protester, was shot to death face first by the cops in Genova, Italy, during the anti-G8 protests, and then they backed over him with a police truck, then all hell broke loose with the protesters, especially with the cops. What does Bush have to say? I know what I believe, and I believe what I believe is right. One last one. This is his commencement address to Yale University, which he somehow managed to graduate from. And to the C students, I say, you too can be President of the United States. Both King Georges have said we have to loosen restrictions on the CIA being able to do dirty tricks with what they called unsavory characters. We need to go back in business with the mob. We need to go back in business with drug lords to get things done and bring back the good old days, like when we assassinated Salvador Allende and put Pinochet in Chile and the Contra War. Well, again, the unsavory characters are already there. They're called the Bush administration. One example is John Negroponte, who was ambassador to Honduras during the Reagan and I think the Bush years too, and is widely believed to have been the guy who ran the Contra War, which killed at least 30,000 people. What's that? Five or six times as many as the World Trade Center. His reward is, no, we're not wanting him as a terrorist. We've made him ambassador to the United Nations. And unsavory characters and the kind of stuff we do with them went a long way towards creating this mess in the first place. For example, in the 1950s, the CIA overthrew a democratically elected government in Iran to install the Shah, to clamp down and beat up on his own people and be a loyal puppet-like friend to the West. We couldn't give him enough weapons, police weapons, fighter planes, tanks, semi-trucks, which nobody there knew how to use, so he would just leave them in rows, according to the New Yorker magazine, on a road leading out of Tehran, where people could just see them rotting as the sand blew through them. And then we gave him more, and we gave him more. And he was so ruthless against his own people that he pretty much killed off or wiped out all moderate opposition to his repressive rule. And so then, when people got so sick of what he was doing to them and couldn't take any more, they had nobody to turn to but a fundamentalist nutcase named Ayatollah Khomeini. But they figured anything is better than the Shah. We don't have anybody else to turn to. Out with the old dictator, in with the new dictator. And so what I'm getting at is, if we hadn't interfered with their democratically elected government in the 50s, we might not have had the Iranian regime and all the other violent fundamentalist uprisings that have come since. 1979, after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the CIA and Pakistan's ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence, which is now being hyped up as by far the best spy agency in the area, launched the largest covert operation in the history of the CIA. Their purpose was to harness the energy of Afghan resistance to the Soviets, harness the energy of Afghan resistance, and expand it into a holy war, an Islamic jihad, which would turn Muslim countries within the Soviet Union against the communist regime and eventually destabilize it. When it began, it was meant to be the Soviet Union's South Vietnam. It turned out to be much more than that. Over the years, through the ISI, the CIA funded and recruited almost 100,000 radical mujahideen from 40 Islamic countries, including Indonesia and the Philippines, all the way to Algeria, as soldiers for America's proxy war. The rank and file of the Mujahideen were unaware that their jihad was actually being fought on behalf of Uncle Sam. The irony is that America was equally unaware it was financing a future war against itself. In 1989, after being bloodied by 10 years of relentless conflict, the Russians withdrew, leaving behind a civilization reduced to rubble. Civil war in Afghanistan raged on. The jihad spread to Chechnya, Kosovo, and eventually to Kashmir. The CIA continued to pour in money and military equipment, but the overheads had become immense and more money was needed. The Mujahideen ordered farmers to plant opium as a revolutionary tax. I suspect they already did, personally. The ISI set up hundreds of heroin laboratories across Afghanistan. Within 2 years of the CIA's arrival, the Pakistan-Afghanistan borderland had become the biggest producer of heroin in the world and the single biggest source of the heroin on American streets. The annual profits said to be between $100 and $200 billion were plowed back into training and arming militants. That's the kind of stuff that for some strange reason you just don't seem to find in the American media. And what's more, one of the main people doing this was the Northern Alliance, which we're trying to put back in power in Afghanistan now. And I'm not so sure they're going to get welcomed back. Well, they're going to get welcomed back. The last time they almost took Kabul, the different factions within the Northern Alliance started fighting each other, and the shooting got so bad that 50,000 people died, and a third of the city was destroyed. And after that, we rewarded some of them with passports and entry into the United States, which eventually trickled into the World Trade Center, the first World Trade Center bombing. Benazir Bhutto, who's been in and out of power in Pakistan a couple times, warned the U.S. government at the time, I think this would have been when King George I was still in the White House, "You are creating a Frankenstein." The UN helped too. Did you see the Channel 4 documentary where it showed Taliban soldiers executing women in a stadium filled with cheering men for such things as being an adulterous widow? There's a lot of widows in that country, and if you hate women as much as they do, you got to dispose of them somehow. That was originally built by the UN in hopes it would bring soccer back to the Afghan people and cheer them up a bit. America's own policies in Afghanistan a decade or more ago helped create both Osama bin Laden and the fundamentalist Taliban regime that shelters him. The notion of jihad, or holy war, had almost ceased to exist in the Muslim world after the 10th century, until it was revived with American encouragement to fire an international pan-Islamic movement after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. I should also interject that we tried that in the 50s and 60s in hopes of overthrowing President Nasser in Egypt as well. For the next 10 years, the CIA and Saudi intelligence together pumped in billions of dollars worth of arms and ammunition through Pakistan's ISI to the many Mujahideen groups fighting in Afghanistan. But there was a terrible legacy. Afghanistan was left awash with weapons, warlords, and extreme religious zealotry. The name given to the young Muslim men who fought the infidel in Afghanistan, have carried their jihad far beyond, to the corrupt kingdoms of the Gulf, to the repressive states of the southern Mediterranean, such as Egypt, and now to New York and Washington. One of the other people we helped finance and train, speaking of unsavory characters, was a young rich guy from Saudi Arabia by the name of Osama bin Laden. Recruited by the Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki al-Faisal, to help raise funds for the jihad, he became central to the recruitment and training of Mujahideen from across the Muslim world. Bin Laden himself fought against the Russians on the side of the ISI's favorite Afghan, I hope I say this right, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, whose Hezbi Islami party became the largest recipient of CIA money. After the Russians withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989, the Americans quickly lost interest in the country. In other words, we couldn't be bothered to finish the job or help out the actual people there. Okay, Soviet unions are gone, we kicked their ass, now you people can just starve to death, your waterworks are blown up, what do we care? Your dope's pretty good, though. And a struggle for power erupted among the various factions of the Mujahideen. But since no group was strong enough to capture and hold Kabul, Afghanistan slumped into anarchy. In 1995-96, a movement of Pathan students Taliban, which means Islamic students, from religious schools in the border regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Those schools are called madrasas, by the way, and are financed by the Saudi government, swept the country, promising restoration of order. They, the Taliban, enjoyed Pakistani backing and almost certainly the approval of the Americans. And even now, according to the USA Today, we're giving the Taliban $140 million in aid every year. And according to Christopher Hitchens, writing in The Nation, they also got a $43 million bonus for fighting drugs. Since they turned on some of their former rivals, like the Northern Alliance, and turned on some of their rivals and declared opium growing un-Islamic and did quite a good job of wiping it out. All this because we couldn't be bothered to finish the job and help rebuild the country and do anything to help the actual people living there. Kind of like the attitude a lot of our governments are taking right now. In the Islamic world, the firing up, blowing up, and abandonment of Afghanistan, once they weren't a useful proxy anymore, is called the Great Betrayal. They don't forget stuff like that, and I think we're a little naive if we expect people to automatically trust us, either government officials or people down below, after something like that. I mean, we left the place, didn't really even bother to get a government set up, so all these different Mujahideen groups turned into warlords, fighting each other, and they had tons and tons of weapons, so many to this day that there's an arms bazaar in the town of Dara Adam Kel near Peshawar out in Pakistan. It's right near the Afghan border at the mouth of the Khyber Pass, where it's like a flea market. You want your M16s? Oh, here's some. Kalashnikovs? Oh, that guy over there's got them this week. Stinger missiles? We gave 200 of them to the Mujahideen. Guess where they are now? Most of them are with the Taliban that they can fire at the infidels when we invade, but you can get them there, too, for whatever purpose you want. How about some grenades, rocket launchers? Oh, go to that guy over there. Somalia, TNT is cheaper than sugar. In Yemen, you can get grenades for practically nothing. We didn't finish the job. And with all that going on, you really think we're ever going to win the war on terrorism? The frightening thing is that Bin Laden does speak for a lot more people over there, and that sentiment is not going to go away overnight. It's kind of important to at least look through these people's eyes, to not just look at the picture of the evil Bin Laden, but to feel Bin Laden. The only interview I ever saw with him came out a couple years ago, and like an idiot, I don't think I saved it. But what I remember of it was, yes, there was some really, really chilling religious fundamentalist dogma going on, but he was not some frothing maniac blindly out to destroy God, Mom, and apple pie. He was very methodical in his explanations on how he became what he is today, starting with, of course, the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. Then he got even more annoyed when the army defending the Saudi royal family in Arabia gunned down a whole bunch of Muslims in Mecca during the pilgrimage in, I think, 1993. And then he said what really sent him over the edge was that the Saudi royal family let the infidels occupy holy ground and desecrate it by letting us use their land to run bombing raids against Saddam Hussein during the Gulf War and then never quite leave the place. He said that Israel didn't concern him nearly as much as overthrowing the House of Saud, the Saudi royal family. When I laid this out to my dad on the phone, he said, yeah, well, why doesn't he blow them up instead of us then? Good point. But he also claimed that all those oil sheiks, the House of Saud, the Al Sabah family in Kuwait and the others, weren't even native to the area, but they were planted there by the British after World War I, when the British drove out the Turks and destroyed the Ottoman Empire and redrew some of the borders as well, such as slicing off a piece of Iraq and giving it to Kuwait that Saddam Hussein tried to get back when he invaded and did not succeed. Designed to plant these people who'd work for the West in power and destabilize everything else to keep the oil flowing for us. And a little further digging revealed that no, these royal families do go back, some of them 100, 200 years or more, but yes, they were cemented in there after World War I, so we would always have access to the oil. You know, there's a lot of the deep hatred going on over there is for our support for these kings and families and repressive regimes like in Egypt, although it's also widely acknowledged that if they held elections in a lot of those countries, fundamentalist parties and Taliban-type groups would probably win. Choice for Vice President Joseph Lieberman, when it came to music, he was like Tipper Gore on crack. Al Gore only held one Senate committee hearing against evil music and called his wife and her society lady friends as the first expert witnesses. Joseph Lieberman has had three in the last 4 years, where he's done things like claim that Marilyn Manson causes high school shootings. And Lieberman, it's not just Marilyn Manson and Eminem that he's trying to get rid of. Lieberman's blacklist included the Black Crows and Blues Traveler as being too risque. And this, of course, all traces back to Tipper. And to make a long story short, after the bust on Dead Kennedys and the Frankenchrist album being the first record in American history ever put on trial for obscenity and anything else, I made a big stink in the media. Frank Zappa helped me get some contacts, and suddenly people who said I was a paranoid lunatic, which perhaps I am at other things, but was a paranoid lunatic because I pointed out Tipper Gore's connections to Jerry Falwell and Focus on the Family, which her partner Susan Baker was on the board of, etc. Now suddenly I wasn't so crazy anymore. And Tipper and I wound up locking horns on the Oprah Winfrey Show. We're in the dressing room. She insisted on giving me this book. And not only did she shove this book at me, she autographed it for me, too. DiGello, please read with an open mind. We can all work for a better society. Well, I thought I was working for a better society by telling people to vote green because her husband was too toxic to be president. And I tried to read it with an open mind. I got 28 pages before she said, "Their brand of rock music has become a Trojan horse, rolling explicit sex and violence into our home." She said other things, too. Eventually, I'd put up enough of a stink that she was starting to get uncomfortable questions, even from the straight media. She said, "Oh, we aren't trying to get anybody busted. We had nothing to do with Cello Biafra. I respect Cello Biafra." But then I get in the mail a cutout from a newspaper called The Metro in Nashville, Tennessee, ask about my trial. "I'd like to take credit for it." This meant war. But little did I guess, a little bit after that, I would be invited to get in the ring with Tipper again on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And, "Are you sure you want me back on the show?" Oprah hated me. She wouldn't let me talk. She'd always give the floor to Tipper Gore with her unseen off-camera hand gesture whenever I tried to say anything. "Don't you remember who I am?" "Oh, that's okay. We want you back on the show." Okay, I'll be ready. This time the format was changed a little bit. There were two dressing rooms now, one for me and Ice-T and one for everybody else on the show. And the other guests were Tipper Gore, a couple of African-American journalists, Rabbi Abraham Cooper from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, who was there to the Wiesenthal Center fights anti-Semitic hate crimes and things. and people attacking Jews. Anyway, Professor Griff of Public Enemy had said some pretty nasty things about Jews, which he has since apologized for. So Rabbi Cooper was suddenly in Tipper's camp, fearing a much wider problem. Oprah shows a video of Axl Rose bashing immigrants, then another one of Ice-T and a song where it has a line in it about doing a woman with a flashlight. The video is stopped. And Ice jumps in. I mean, I've never seen anybody take over talk shows as good as he does. Yeah, well, some people like to do it with a flashlight. Oprah did not know what to do. So then I did my spiel and pointed out all her religious right connections, including some of the people she's associated with and endorses in her book, like the Back and Control Center, who said the Jewish Star of David was a symbol of devil worship and occult graffiti, as they called it. Rabbi Cooper got interested. Tipper looked flabbergasted. I'm so shocked at you, Jello. You'd say those things. I have no connections with Jerry Falwell or any of those people. I'm a liberal Democrat, and I never tried to take credit for your trial. Oh, yes, you did. Pulled it out, read it to her. The audience starts booing and hissing a little bit. And what kind of an example are you setting for your own kids when they see you lying on national television? Oh, Oprah jumps in. Well, I'm sure you've been misquoted too before, haven't you, Jello? In no way did that prepare me for the phone call I got in January of 2000. Hi, this is the New York State Green Party. We just had our state convention and nominated you for president. In addition to Ralph Nader, want to run? I hadn't penciled in run for president on my calendar this year. I'm flattered that you'd ask, but I'm perfectly happy with Nader as the candidate myself, and I'm not going to have a whole lot of time to campaign because, as many of you know, the former members of my old band, Dead Kennedys, have been suing the shit out of me for almost 4 years now because I wouldn't let them put Holiday in Cambodia in a Levi's commercial. And I'm grateful for all the support, but I've suffered kind of dearly for that. To put it mildly, there were other disagreements going on about accounting that we were trying to solve as adults and everything together, but as soon as I wouldn't do Levi's, they went ballistic and went to a corporate lawyer who'd represented Journey, Boston, Doobie Brothers, Carlos Santana. We're talking real punk grassroots ethics here. And would not compromise, dragged me through a jury trial, much more nerve-wracking than the Frankenchrist trial. And Ray, Klaus, and D.H. Peligro each went on the witness stand and lied, claiming they wrote all the music, the songs, and, Biafra couldn't have written any of the things that he's credited for on the albums. He snuck all those credits by us. They didn't look at the albums for 15 to 20 years. Knowing them, maybe not at this point. Well, he couldn't have written any of that because he doesn't play an instrument and he doesn't read sheet music. They said that. And yes, there was, they claimed I plotted to hide all this money from them, and worse yet, use money they thought should have been theirs to help other bands on an independent label. No Means No, Alice Donut, Wesley Willis, Neurosis, the newer ones, Ayahuasca, who's from England and who's going to be touring soon, Phantom Limbs, Fleshy, Slim Sesma's Auto Club. Anyway, all of that money should have gone into their pockets, they claimed. No label operates that way, but they wanted damages for that. Yes, there was an accounting mistake in the royalties, but when we, not they, we found it, We paid them. A quarter of it was mine, after all. I'm not going to rip off myself, let alone anybody else. And then they sued after they got paid. And they brought up an expert witness from Grateful Dead Records, of all places, who testified that I should be forced to pay them $500,000 in blood money, in damages, because they weren't, for lack of promotion. What did they ever do to promote the band? But lack of promotion because they were not regularly on MTV, in spite of the song MTV Get Off the Air, which they now claim they wrote. And not regularly in Rolling Stone, in music industry showbiz publications like Billboard. They wanted damages because they weren't on MTV's cousin VH1, who specializes in older adult fare like James Taylor videos and stuff. And to their own visible shock, the jury believed them. And so as of now, they've been able to swipe most of the albums, except for Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables, which is on Cherry Red. And they have been given the right to do whatever they want, pimp them however they want, that they, not I, control my songs, my lyrics, my music, the artwork I did for the albums, Winston Smith's artwork, my name, my face. They can do whatever they want with at this point. When so many people my age, I know, don't have any more tangible personal memories of Vietnam or even Watergate when we were 16 and it was on everybody's lips. Some of them don't even remember what happened with Reagan or, more importantly, what was possible before Reagan and why there weren't so many homeless people before Reagan, etc. The memory's gone. History's erased. Same with people in Germany who are 20 years old, 25, no memory of the Berlin Wall or anything or what life was like before that. And that's scary in a way. And I think the reason for that is, say, with my generation, when the really bloody footage of Vietnam or the Biafra War where I got my name or the race riots came on TV, they changed the channel because they didn't want to upset the kids. You know, don't change the channel. You can explain it to them. I mean, like my parents said, okay, this is what war is really like, and this is why it's wrong, this is why racism is wrong, etc., etc. And that also means if you have a kid later during the difficult years, don't listen to Tipper Gore. You know, if a kid brings home something that might genuinely be offensive, well, for hypothetical example, the Eminem album or something, if you take it away from the kid, all that proves is, well, I should just go to the store and buy another one, but not be so open and honest with my parents anymore about what I'm listening to. It divides families. No, you sit down and say, okay, you went out and spent your money on this. Why? Well, I like it. The music's cool. Slim Shady's hilarious. Well, what do you think about what he's saying about beating the shit out of women and bashing gays and all? I don't know. Well, I do know, and this is why I don't think that's such a cool thing. It's a way of instilling values. If you don't hide reality from your kids, they're going to be a lot more aware as adults. And another real good thing about the so-called spirit of Seattle, even though to me it was like the spirit of Europe and the poll tax riots finally migrated across the Atlantic. But if they're going to call it the spirit of Seattle, okay, just so long as it keeps going. One of the other cool things is it's not everybody just following some other leader who's going to make everything all better again. I mean, there's no Nelson Mandela, no Vaclav Havel, no Subcommandante Ski Mask riding in on a white horse to lead everybody else to the promised land. We're doing it together. Yes, there's organizers and smaller leaders, but everybody's working together as kind of a wedge, and the wedge is a lot bigger to include everybody who can't put food on the table when you think about it, or just willing to communicate with them. But anyway, another thing to think about is that a lot of times when a bad government or thing falls, sometimes it happens unexpectedly and quickly, like the fall of the Berlin Wall, or the more inspiring examples, at least in the short run, the revolutions in South Africa and the former Czechoslovakia. When those bad dictatorships finally fell, they fell quickly and unexpectedly, but luckily, unlike the Balkans or some of the African countries, etc., I'm almost done, believe me. the hardline, hardcore, frontline radical opposition was ready to move in and take the place and fill the void, and they knew not only what they didn't want, but they knew what they wanted. And, 2 minutes. And in order to get there, when corporate power has its inevitable train wreck, we got to start thinking in terms of, okay, we know what we don't want, what do we want? And more importantly, what would I do if I was in Blair's shoes or in Bush's shoes or was mayor of London or was running, trying to reform the police? What would I do if I was in place of the boss I don't like at work? How would I run it differently and make it work? An ongoing mental exercise that can't help but make you smarter and also help identify what you might be able to offer, what you're good at, what you know that other people are going to need later on. Because if we aren't ready to do it right when corporate power has its little train wreck sometime in our lifetime, we will get fooled again. Thanks for coming. See you.